We have a very exciting program today here, and I know that the fiction writers in the audience are here basically watch how their next book covers poisons. So we have two terrific speakers. One of them are, and they're going to have a conversation. The first is our chapter member, Douglas P. Lyle. Now, Jan Burke points out to me, we made Doug everything he is. He used to be just the doctor, but Jan induced him to write a column called The Doctor Is In for the chapter newsletter, and we made him everything he is. MWA made him everything he is. And Doug decided, I guess, that was kind of fun, and took it to the point of really getting quite silly about it, writing books like Forensic for Dummies, Murder and Fiction, what's that one called? Something about fiction. Something and fiction.
Forensics and fiction.
Murder and Mayhem is the other one. A Doctor Answers Medical and Forensic Questions for Mystery Writers. He still occasionally squeezes in a little bit of practice medicine in addition to writing books about forensics and novels. Our other speaker is Dave Chambroni. Dave is a former SoCal chapter member. Who thought he was coming to speak to us as an excuse to come out and visit his daughter, but ended up doing it just for us. Dave is a retired scientist, magician, manager, oceanographer, archaeologist, engineering professor, and an author. He lives in Georgetown, Texas, and has written nonfiction management books, helpful hint newspaper columns, and they're about things like how to poison your neighbor and stuff like that. So, Doug and Dave, come on up, and...
Is let me get this over here. Let you guys sit in the front.
Cool. And this is the microphone here for just.
You
don't have to hold it up. You can just talk.
Okay.
It'll pick it up. Thanks.
Hello, Clarice.
Divorce?
Jan is the godmother of my entire career. God bless you.
Well, the moral of the story is contribute to the newsletter because you can start another career.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're going to talk about poisons, and I know you guys love poisons. Guys like guns, women like poisons. And so when you write novels, women seem to love poisons. I've always heard because women know that they have to clean up the crime scene afterwards. They don't like a lot of blood. And a guy would just live with it. And based on the questions that I get from writers, I mean, poisons are a huge, huge, huge issue. They've been around forever.
Oh, yeah.
And they've been used since man first started walking upright, basically. People have poisoned each other with stuff. And many great people throughout history have used them to... further their careers.
Still do.
And arsenic has been around forever and ever and is still around and still used. But what I want to talk about a little bit is poisons that people can easily access and that you don't have to be all that sophisticated to use. In fact, you don't even have to leave the house. So what kind of things would people have around their house, particularly plant stuff, and in their backyard and garden and herb garden and flower garden and trees and shrubs and house plants?
You know, most people, when they go to give a talk, carry three by five cards for notes. When you get to be my age, this is the 3x5 cards. Around the house, it's funny, there's a lot of things that are extremely deadly around the house. In the kitchen, you have, especially for somebody with high blood pressure, you got salt. Baking soda. Overdose of baking soda if someone's got a bad heart. Water. Too much water will kill. In the bathroom, you've got, of course, aspirin. Ibuprofen, if you're taking certain drugs, like diuretics. There's any number of them, things like that. If you're out in the garage and you have antifreeze, it's got oxalic acid, basically it's an oxalate. It forms oxalic acid in the body, which doesn't do the body much good. It even floods up the kidneys. In the garage, you've also got the radiator cleaner. But nothing to gasoline. Of course, who would drink gasoline? Better explode. Using that for an explosive, so about a gallon of that is equivalent to about 7 sticks of dynamite, if used correctly. Now, in the yard, well, another thing, you've got rat poison, pesticides, Pesticides are great. I mean, a lot of the pesticides are based on chemical weapons, especially the organophosphates. These are used for primarily, they were developed for the military, for killing anything that moved around, you know, for breathed dead. You got borax. Eat borax. You can reach 20 meals in borax or wash your hands. Great. Don't eat it. You've got a number of these types of things. Herbicides. The 2D, 2D is one. I got the whole name in here, but it's about that long. The you know, these things, you know, they're supposed to kill plants, will kill you too. And a lot of it, the difference between, as Jan put it, the remedy and the poison is the dosage. Like I used to tell my class when I teach, when I was teaching college, that all chemicals are poisons. Matter of fact, drugs are poisons. It's just a matter of how much you use to get the reaction that you're trying to get. In the case of Dr. Lyle here, he tries to cure you. In the case of me, you may have to see him if you can make it that far. The I tend to, you know, if a little bit is good, a lot's got to be better. Right? So any number of these regular household things that you could go buy. Now these aren't, we're not talking about plants yet. We're talking about things around the house. I mean, other examples in here. Alcohol, rubbing alcohol, great killer. Now the thing that's cute, if you take wood alcohol, you've heard of that one, methyl alcohol, that's what basically turns into formaldehyde in the body. So you're getting ready to go to the undertaker in the way.
Alcoholics really drink both of those a lot.
Yeah.
They also drink antifreeze a lot for some reason.
Yeah, because it tastes sweet
and it's got that alcohol burn. And
right, and you get the same kind of reaction, but it kills you.
Yeah, yeah.
The old joke about the wood alcohol, you have to turn on the lights.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that you go blind. And then you die. You know.
As a medical student, I had a patient once who was an alcoholic and he happened to have a heart attack and he comes in, been in the hospital 4 or 5 days. And one of my classmates, I'm a junior medical student, one of my classmates sees him down in the canteen at the VA. He said, what the hell are you doing down here? You're supposed to be upstairs in bed. He said, I had to come in here and get something. Well, I go in a couple hours later to make rounds, and he's in a coma. What he went down to get is he bought 3 bottles of Aqua Velva. Smelled like a French whorehouse. But he was in a coma and damn near died. So Aqua Velva will kill you too.
Oh, yeah. Any of these compounds, if you take a look at them, that have a lot of alcohol in them, I mean, you're not dealing with just like getting drunk on wine or beer. Some of these things, this isn't necessarily the same alcohol. It can kill you. Another one that I think is kind of cute is what they call cationic detergents. These are better known as fabric softeners. These things wreck the kidneys very well. And it takes a few days to die, too. I mean, this is not pleasant. You know, drives the doctor that's trying to figure out what went wrong up the wall. So, yeah, alcohol. Now, one of them I actually remember somebody actually did, and I can't figure out how the hell they did it. They died by eating naphthalene. Mothballs. Now, why the hell you'd eat a mothball is beyond me. It was more than one. But, yeah, these are things you can have around the house. Phosphates are always good, especially somebody that's on dialysis. You got to get them before they go on the dialysis because it'll take the phosphates out, but that'll work. Overdose of laxatives. And basically, you're cleaning out everything. I mean, it's... Now, we have... There is a... In the chemistry departments, chemistry classes, there's a pH indicator that is used quite a bit. It's called phenolphthalein. It used to be in S-lax because it is a violent laxative. And on some of the same talk units that we had was in college, we had the pure ethyl alcohol in one of our labs, in our nuclear chem lab.
Yeah, we used to steal it.
Yeah, we had to sign for it. And we really guarded this because we had to sign for it and all that stuff. What we used to do is put it in some oranges and stick it in oranges and then go down to the beach party.
Yeah.
The screwdriver, right? In the orange, so natural. But on one of the holidays, the maintenance group, some of the maintenance guys, stole our alcohol. So we got royally upset. So the next holiday coming up, we put diesel fuel in it. Well, the dean got upset because we tried to poison the maintenance department. And he said, no more poison in the alcohol. Okay. So the Christmas holiday was coming up. We put phenolphthalein in the alcohol. Oh, we cleaned their clock. Oh, that was good. Good thing our dean had a sense of humor about that one. But we could have probably hurt them pretty good. We're talking about the organophosphates in the pesticides. Some of the ones that you may have heard of is malathion, parathion, diazone, these compounds that you go down to the hardware store and buy. Now, if you use it as directed, for you, it's not bad. But when they say put on protective gear, like gloves and wear long sleeves and protection for your eyes and your mouth, do it.
This stuff, these things will absorb through your skin.
Yeah.
Like sarin and VX gas are basically organophosphates.
Right.
And all these others came out of that.
I got interested in this stuff because I used to work with chemical and biological weapons. And those things are a little nasty. Another one that's kind of interesting.
And a little dab will do you.
Yeah, a little dab will do you. Some of it doesn't take a whole lot. The old days, when you used to have, probably not many around anymore, the old refrigerators. Remember those? Where people would have them out in the back porch for, you know, storing beer and stuff. Then they would put them, when they finally broke, they'd have them outside. Well, the grates inside were too neat, right? Those things never corroded. So it saves the grates. Every so often, somebody would build a barbecue. The grates would make a great barbecue grate, right? They're steel, right? Stainless steel. They look like they're not. They're plated with cadmium. Cadmium goes from solid to a gas, right into the meat. We don't worry about the person coming back and, you know, having another dinner with you. But that is, you know, that's mercury salts. Now, mercury salts are still used as for joints, but they're extremely deadly. Now, mercury itself, they talk about. You know, don't touch the mercury and so on. Almost all of us have played with mercury when we were kids, right? You broke the thermometer and you played with it. You're probably not going to die from that. And in fact, I know one guy that actually drank some mercury, and basically it went through him. Stomach changed some of it, but it's a heavy metal. I mean, pick up a bottle of mercury, it weighs a ton. But the salts are what are extremely poisonous. Now, you ever heard of the Mad Hatter?
Yeah.
From the cartoons and stuff? The Hatters in England used to go mad. That's where the term came from, because they used mercury salts and mercury to make fat. And they were breathing it, and they got it on their skin.
Yeah, and the pelting process, they had to use mercury.
Right. So, and the gilders, everybody know what a gilder is? Gilding? Gilders putting gold on something. Well, to get gold to go, they didn't have electroplating until we...
That's not a fixed horse, that's another.
That's
a gilding.
That's a gilding. So the gilder, what they would do is they had to put, let's say, go to make a gold goblet for the king or for some nobleman. They couldn't electroplate it in those days. They didn't have what we have today. So what they would do is dissolve mercury in mercury gold. Gold, if you think gold is readily solved, solvent dissolved in at room temperature is mercury. It's an amalgam. Then they would rub it on the, like the pewterware or whatever. Then they would slowly turn it over a flame. Drive off the mercury, the gold stays on the goblet. They're breathing it. So they went mad and died. They paid them real well because they didn't live very long. But that's one of the things that happened with gilders, that they got very well paid because they didn't live very long.
One of the things in history is they think that Mozart may have had mercury poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things, he wrote symphonies actually for a thing called a water flute. And it was a glass instrument that you put water in, and it had holes. It worked like a flute, and you'd wet your fingers, and that's how it worked. Well, each of the little openings were painted a different color, and they had mercury-containing paints.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I think the one that he used to write, and it was given to him by Ben Franklin or something like that. But anyway, so he would, you know, wet his fingers and then play the flute and write these symphonies for this little instrument. But he loved it, and he played it all the time. They said he worked out a lot of stuff, and they think maybe the mercury from those paints over time accumulated and made him go completely goofy.
Yeah, they just use lead in some of those,
yeah,
too. Yeah, now the salts of lead, gold, copper, zinc, most of those metals, the salts, are poisonous. Now, you have to have a certain amount of these elements to live. But we're talking milligrams and micrograms, not, you know, we're going to, a little bit of scoop will give you a lot. You know, this might be a two-finger drink, you know. Vitamin A, excess vitamin A. I mean, call it excess vitamin A. Vitamin D, iron, B12, these are things you got around the house. You going to the yard?
Sure.
Okay.
That is going to be the next question. What happens when we go in the backyard?
Okay. You can actually go out and buy a castor bean plant. Okay? Castor beans are great. They got resin. You heard that? That's the stuff the spies use to kill somebody? You know, they inject a little BB in your leg or your back or your arm, and you die. Okay? It takes a little while, a couple of days to die, but
there's no treatment.
So he's not going to stop it from happening. It takes about 0.035 milligrams to do it. That's why the spies like to use it. It doesn't take a whole lot. You know, little dab will do you. Now, I think in the book, I'm not going to go in today on how to make it out of your kitchen. You can. Water hemlock, oleander. Of course, now tobacco, nicotine, pure nicotine, is extremely deadly. That's why the doctors will tell you, if you got the patch, don't smoke. It doesn't take a whole lot.
Yeah, nicotine is extremely toxic.
Yeah, you're talking a few milligrams to do it there. Monkswood, also called wolfbane, a few milligrams of that will do it, and basically you're in convulsions when that happens. How many of you remember the 60s and early 70s when everybody
no.
was smoking everything? Nobody's going to admit to that, right? Okay, I'm old. I told Columbus he should have made a right turn. So the old days, what they would do is they would smoke everything. I mean, so they tried smoking bananas. They started smoking. Yeah, if you name it, they smoked it, right? Well, one of the things somebody found out that they could do, really cute, was they would take a potato and cut the eyes out. You know, the grandma told you when you bake a potato or cook a potato, cut the eyes out and you clean it. And did we tell you why? Okay, I'm going to tell you. What these guys did was they would cut the eyes out, chop it up, and dry it, put it in their pipes, and smoke it. Well, they didn't have to worry about lung cancer because it killed them. The eyes of a potato are deadly. Matter of fact, a green potato, green parts of a potato are extremely deadly. They make you sick, probably. If you have enough of them, it'll kill you. But the eyes of a potato, those little gross, are extremely deadly. And people actually, of course, these guys were smoking it. You know, they concentrated it. They got it, chopped it up, dried it, put it in the pipe, and boom. But, you know, they smoked everything. Mistletoe?
Yeah.
I love mistletoe. You can kiss your lover goodbye. Berries of mistletoe will kill you. Bloodroot. Oh, the one I love is draproot. That's dead tongue. That's the name for it. You can go buy it. It deadens the tongue. It tastes like parsnips. It looks really innocuous. It'll kill you in about 3 hours. Nice plant. But it deadens your tongue, so that's why it got its name. Foxglove. Beautiful flowers. Some of these things you can dig. Go down to Home Depot, you can buy them. We all know what that is. That's digitalis. If you've got a bad heart, you've got a problem. If you had a good heart, you've still got a problem. Now, one I love is Ignatius plant. Ignatius beans. It's named after St. Ignatius. The Jesuits liked this one. Now, why the Jesuits were interested in this plant is beyond me. But it contains strychnine. Nice guys. You said you're going to get rid of their bows. Another one that you can go buy is called deadly nightshade. The Latin is Atropina belladonna. And guess what it contains? Atropine and belladonna. Now, atropine is also used, I believe that's the one that's used for cyanide poisoning, as an antidote.
Antidote, yes.
Yeah. But if he administers it, it'll cure you. If I give it to you...
It's also used in organophosphate.
Yes, yes. So I mean, some of these things have, a lot of these, have, even these plants, the root of these plants, have medical uses. But...
Most of them do.
Yeah, but they're deadly. Strychnosos nox vomica. That's a nice long term, right? Contains strychnine. It's a tree.
Which is a very pleasant way to die.
Yeah.
All the muscles of the body go berserk. You end up with the convulsions and spasms, and it's extremely painful.
And when you're done, you're basically arched.
Yeah.
Like that. Metal saffron, lily of the valley. That one is real cute. All the parts of that is a Jimson weed. That's a hallucinogenic, but it's also fatal. Yeah.
And they smoked that in the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
Jimson weed was big.
Big.
And if you didn't die, you had a good trip.
Yeah. Well, you either had a good trip or you died.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Sometimes you didn't worry about coming down.
Exactly.
Now, one of my favorites, because it's easy to make, is botulism. You can make this in the house. Make this in the kitchen.
Yeah.
It's easy. But it doesn't take a whole lot. 0.03 milligrams. We'll do it. And that one's a cute one. I'm not going to tell you how to do that one either. Mm-hmm. I think it's in the book. But there's mushrooms. If you don't know, if you're not raising commercial mushrooms, don't go picking them. Buy them at Ralph's. Because some of you are like, oh, I know. You got to look for this. You pick it up and you look for this thing. That will kill you. That will drive you to see him.
No, it won't. The worst, thing about mushrooms is that they don't really hit you for 12 to 48 hours. So you eat them and all the toxin gets in the system. And you don't start developing symptoms till very late in the game.
And, you don't
and by the time you start developing symptoms, it could be a day later. And it's very hard to figure out. And by the time you develop symptoms, the damage is overwhelming. Kidneys, liver,
mm-hmm. nerves.
That's what makes them so dangerous. And that's why they call them death cap mushrooms.
That's about three or four different families of these things. And they're some are nerve poisons, some are different type of gastro poisons and stuff. Another one that's interesting, I helped a sheriff with this one. Diffenbachia. You've been in a house about Diffenbachia. Well, what it does is constricts, one of the things it does is constricts your throat, so you can't breathe. But if you get just a little bit, you can't talk. Well, what happened, I got a call from a sheriff. Now I live here in California. I got a call from, of all places, a sheriff in Texas. I go, why the hell am I here? Now I live in Texas, so not with that sheriff. But he called, and he wanted to know. He said they had two guard dogs at this place that was robbed, but the dogs weren't supposed to attack. They were supposed to bark, and that would trigger some sort of device that would alert people that there was a problem. They didn't bark. He said, can you help me? So, well, don't you have a crime lab? Don't you have, you know? He said, we're a rural county. We don't have a whole lot. He said, so if we get a big case or something, we're stuck. We got to call in the Rangers. And I'd really like to do this myself. Well, dogs didn't bark. But check the dog's food or their droppings for Diffenbachia. And if you find it, take about a 50-mile radius around you and find out any place that sells plants, Home Depot, a nursery. Look for this one and see if whoever bought it used a credit card. If they bought it with cash, you're out of luck. Unless the guy remembers who sold it to. Well, it was about 2 weeks later, I got a call from the sheriff. Bucks had Diffenbachia. They couldn't bark. They got the guy. They found the place that sold it. He used a credit card. So then I landed in Texas. So, morning glories. Somebody like that weed, the morning glories? They're not too good. Mountain laurel, nice plants. Yeah, the dog couldn't bark. That's right. Yellow sage, also called lantana. Now, this one is one I like. How many people like rhubarb? Like to eat rhubarb?
Yeah.
From not very farm, you get the rhubarb with your chicken dinner. The stalk that you eat is really good. The leaf will kill you. Okay? It contains oxalic acid, just like the yellow freeze does.
Exactly.
And it's not real good for you. The yew, somebody mentioned those. How many people are familiar with Jack in the Pulpit plant? Or wake robin? Same plant. This has medical uses. It's expectorant and a diaphoretic. It's also poison. So a lot of these plants have medical uses. Metal saffron is another one. That one is really bad. I'll just list off some of these. Hydrangea, Jack of Pulpit mentioned, horse chestnut, narcissus, daphne, rhododendrons, azaleas, milkweeds, autumn crocus, talk about that one, daphne, holly, hyacinth, narcissus, and daffodils, the bulbs, are dangerous. Apple seeds, about a cup, ionite.
Mm-hmm.
Apricot, cherry, peach, and palm. Plum, the leaves, twigs, and seeds. Again, you can eat the fruit. And a lot of these plants, like the eggplant I mentioned, you can eat the eggplant, but you can't eat the leaves. Poinsettia, geraniums. How many people have geraniums in New York? The leaves are poisonous. Indians in Southern California used to tip their arrows with it, the oil, to stop an animal or their enemy. If you've got little kids, keep them away from there. Now you can go buy, if you're interested in cyanide, you can go buy it at a chemical supply house. You don't need a prescription, you don't need a license.
You can order it on the internet.
You can order it on the internet. If they ask a question, tell them your silver or gold plating.
Do what?
May I ask a question?
Yes.
All these dozens and dozens of normal items and plants and things, can you suggest which ones that we want to kill somebody?
Okay. Glad you asked.
Be the next question.
Yeah. Okay. Before I get to that, let me give you a couple others that are interesting. Nitrogen gas. I love this one because if you got a person in a confined space and you put a tube under there and you put nitrogen into the room. Now remember, nitrogen is mostly what's in the air. basically, of course, they will die from lack of oxygen, but their lungs fill up with water. So to the not a forensic forensic pathologist who may or may not figure it out, but to the average pathologist, look like he died of drowning. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not... You can take the bottles away and you don't need a license to have them. Another one is dimethyl sulfoxide, DMSO. It's a horse liniment. It's also an industrial solvent. Great stuff. It'll dissolve almost anything that water will dissolve. It's great stuff. The only thing is, if you touch it, you get it on your hands, you'll taste it immediately. I mean, as soon as you pull the finger out, you'll taste it without doing this. It goes right through your skin and into your system. However, anything you dissolve in it will go through the skin barrier. So put some snake venom in it or anything that'll dissolve in it, and you get it on the person's skin, it goes right through the skin and into their skin.
The DMSO helps carry whatever the other chemical is in the bloodstream.
Right through the skin and into the bloodstream. And there's no needle marks.
No.
There's no... It goes right through the skin. So
and that's pleasant.
So medical examiner looks at, well, we've got no needle marks. There's no, it is DMSO. No. Great stuff. We talked about... tropical plant, tropical fish store, and get the fugu fish, F-U-G-U. This is the puffer fish. You have it for your saltwater aquarium? A little egg sac. It's deadly. Matter of fact, in Japan, to cook that fish, those people who prepare it are licensed. Because if you screw up, you just lost a customer.
And basically, the delicacy, when you eat it, it makes you tingle and feel warm and flushed all over. And what it is low-level poison.
Right.
It's a neurotoxin. It's the same. It's tetrodotoxin. It's the same thing they use to make zombie powder, which is real.
Yeah.
Which is real. And it's used in Haiti and the Algiers area of New Orleans and in voodoo rituals. It is real. And it comes from the puffer fish.
Yeah. And a little bit that hide, that feeling they get is a little bit that's left. A little more, and they don't worry about it.
And you stop breathing.
Now, another one that's kind of cute is these detergent, dishwasher soaps are poisonous. Not your hand soap that you use. I mean, any soap is not a good idea to drink it, but dishwasher soaps are not real swift for you. Over-the-counter diet pills are cute. Now, you had a question.
But before we do that, let me give you some perspective. If every chemical can either be what we call homeopathic, which means it doesn't do anything, it's background noise. If we tested everybody in here, you would have cyanide, arsenic, mercury, lead, all that in your system. Because it's in the environment, and it was in the environment long before we started polluting the environment.
Mercury?
It's just part of this planet, and it's part of being a carbon-based organism. And so we have a certain level. That's of no value whatsoever. So finding something doesn't mean much. It's the level inside the body that counts. Then we go to the one that actually has effects, and we call those therapeutic effects when they're in the medical term. Like we give somebody digitalis, we want to control an arrhythmia, we want to strengthen the heart muscle, we want to do something, and there's a very fine, what we call a therapeutic range. It's very narrow for digitalis. A little bit more, and you become toxic. And that means you start developing side effects. With digitalis, for instance, it's yellow vision, it's nausea, it's cardiac arrhythmia, it's palpitations, shortness of breath, things like this. And then there's the lethal dose, which is what's above that. And there's a term called the LD50, which means lethal dose 50. And what that means is that if you give 100 people this dose, it'll kill 50 of them.
Half the population.
Yeah, and that's what LD50% is what that stands for. Now, if you go back in history, all of the medicines and everything that they've talked about here, every one of these basically has a place in medicine, or at one time did, and fell in disfavor because of side effects or problems, or it wasn't effective, or better things came along. But they were all used. Medicine way back 2,000 years ago was what we called empiric. People would do something and see what happened. And then they would remember it and tell somebody else, this worked. And Galen, who was the great Greek physician in the first century A.D., Galen was known as the greatest physician in the world. He was an arrogant shit, but he wrote voluminously. I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands of pages. But he was an empiric scientist and one of the first, where he would go give doses of things to people and see what happened, and then record them, which was incredibly important in the beginning of scientific research. And now we use empirical research all the time for stuff. You got to try something to see what happens. To the point that from that point forward, all the herbal medicine became known as galenicals, because they were Galen. And I was in Dubrovnik about 10 years ago, and we went into a pharmacy, and here was all of these jars of these herbs and powders and stuff, and you would tell the pharmacist, what, you know, I have a headache, and they would mix two or three things together and give it to you. This is stuff from 2,000 years ago, and yet it's still going on. We call them health food stores now, but it's basically the same thing. But the point is that all of these poisons and toxins and things got their beginning in this empirical medicine. Now, Galen held sway on medicine, and every physician in every country in the world basically followed Galen up until the Renaissance, and sometimes beyond.
How do you spell it?
G-A-L-E-N. Yeah, he was a physician to the gladiators during Roman times, and really was, I mean, quite a bright guy. But he was wrong. He was dead wrong on so many things, but his belief system lasted until the 1800s.
Now, I wonder if you could address new technology, what scans the toxicologists can use to find things.
Sure.
So
that's kind of what your other question was.
I once killed somebody with potassium chloride.
It'll work.
The theory that potassium chloride are both in the system.
Potassium chloride in your system.
Yeah.
It's necessary for life, yes.
Now, as far as being able to find it, you got to understand, a lot of places, the coroner's office is run by a guy who's elected, right? Because it could be the gas station attendant who won the election. In Texas, where I come from, a lot of the counties don't have coroners. They have justice of the peace, who maybe took a 40-hour course. And he's going to determine he goes to a scene as a dead body.
And he's got a budget of about $3.
Right. And he decides whether this body's going to be shipped to, like, Austin or Fort Worth or Dallas for a forensic autopsy, or whether they're going to do it at the local hospital with a pathologist there, who's not a forensic pathologist, he's a clinical pathologist. And they're going to see if they can find, right? So the chances of, unless the body is, there's something that's going to really show the first guy on the scene that maybe this person was poisoned, like, you know, frothing at the mouth or whatever, it may never get found. If it goes to the lab, they have standard panels, or what they call panels, or tests, that they look for certain things. It's gas chromatographs and things like that, mass specs. And they look for certain drugs, certain things that they may expect to find. If you've got something that's outside that panel, unless that doctor is suspicious or has got a lot of experience, says, you know, when I was, maybe I interned in this, or I've my experience, this guy looks like he may have had this or that, they will go run some other tests. But if he's not suspicious of anything, you know, the guy is a funny color or he's not, they may never find it. They may never even look for it. Because they got money. It also costs money to run these tests.
A lot of money.
So if unless there's a reason to do it, or it's a high profile case, they may never run it.
A toxicological screen, we do it the same thing in the emergency room that the coroner does, basically. If someone comes in a coma and comes into the emergency room and is brought in and they were found down, and that's a medical term, found down, it really is, and they're unconscious, one of the things you do is you order a tox screen. I mean, you check blood sugars and you go through all the other stuff. It could be a diabetic, it could be lots of things. But one of the things you do is a tox screen. Now, what that looks at in most, it's different from jurisdiction, hospital to hospital, but a tox screen will look at things like aspirin, which is extremely common. It looks at amphetamines, alcohol, barbiturates, what's called the benzodiazepine sedatives, which is Valium, Xanax, things like this, narcotics, and cocaine and marijuana. Because they're common. And most toxicological screens will look at that. The reason is these are fast, cheap, simple to do, relatively speaking. So if someone is in a coma and you're suspecting a narcotic, well, if you do a tox screen and it comes back as a narcotic is present, Then you'll go to the next step, which is the confirmatory testing that costs more and takes a longer period of time. The tox screen you can get done in a few hours. That takes more time. And what they will do is they will determine, okay, we found narcotics. What is it? Is it heroin, which they don't really test for? They break down a type of morphine, 4-acetylmorphine, which is a breakdown product. Is it codeine? Maybe they, you know, had a cough medicine. Is it morphine? What kind of narcotic is it? Same way with amphetamines. There's a difference between finding just an amphetamine and finding Sudafed, pseudoephedrine, versus finding methamphetamine. You see, it's a different, you're looking at a whole different ball game here. But if the amphetamine or narcotic screen is negative, there's no point in looking for any more because they're not there. That's what the screen does, is tells you there's a class. Look for this class. If the tox screen is negative all the way up and down, then it either means that a toxin's not involved and something else is going on. The person either died or is in a coma for some other reason, or it's something that doesn't show up in the screen. And that's thousands and thousands and thousands of
them. And it doesn't work like the show on television where the guy running over to the lab, they say, test this, and the guy comes running in 10 minutes later and says, oh, he had in it some exotic compound.
Right.
The lab hasn't got a clue. And if they start going through all of the, there's protocols you go through in a chemical lab to find what it, whatever it might be. These things can take weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not talking about doing it in an hour like they do on television.
And it's very expensive.
It's very expensive.
Who justifies that next test?
What do you mean, who justified?
Well, if a guy comes in a coma, tox screen doesn't show anything, who says?
The coroner.
Oh, really?
Coroner, the medical examiner, decides, because if it's a criminal, potentially criminal case,
right,
he has jurisdiction.
He has jurisdiction over
the body. The police have jurisdiction over the scene and all the other stuff, but he has jurisdiction over the body. And what he has to do at the end of the day is fill out the death certificate. And he has to really determine three things: time of death, if he can; cause of death, if he can; and manner of death, which is natural, suicidal, accidental, homicidal, or I don't know. And sometimes he doesn't know at the end of the day. But everything depends on that. And he will do what he needs to do and can afford to do to make that determination. So if an elderly woman dies in a nursing home in a small town, he may not do an autopsy, because who's going to do it and who's going to pay for it? He might just say, well, she's old and she died, and miss the fact that she was actually smothered with a pillow or injected with digitalis or potassium chloride, because it's too expensive to find all this stuff out. And who's going to pay for it?
In the case of a coma victim who's still alive,
different story.
Yeah.
Then the physicians are more pressed, because you've got a living, breathing person here, and you will go a whole lot further. In that case, the physician's in charge.
How much is the insurance?
He will order whatever. Actually, we don't pay attention to that. That's not their problem. But I mean, now the point is that if you've got somebody in a coma, you better find out why. And you better look under every stone and spend whatever money you've got to spend to find out. It's different than a corpse. Now, if there's an insurance involved, or foul plays is suspected, it changes everything. But if it's somebody who just dies, and that's not unusual that someone like that would die, if it's a 22-year-old found dead versus a 92-year-old, it makes a lot of difference.
And also the person. If a high-profile person is going to get a lot more attention than Joe Slomatovich, who dropped dead.
Exactly.
They don't care. Yeah.
One of the plot problems of these things is always the, you know, why did you call police? One of the things I wondered about is what do you use that will actually take somebody out quickly enough so that they don't call an ambulance or whatever? Because poisons usually hurt. They usually take a long time. And what's the point of this?
Rapid acting poisons are few, but they're present. And the route of administration is critically important. Whereas you can drink some potassium and it may take you an hour, it's going to taste very salty. And it may take an hour to absorb in the body enough to shut your heart down, but you inject it, it takes about 4 seconds.
Let me give you a couple.
Cyanide will kill you quickly. Most things have to be absorbed and processed by the body, most poisons. But if they're smoked, which is almost exactly like giving it intravenously, because the lungs are this huge, vast network of blood, of almost directly to the bloodstream, and it goes like this. And that's why crack cocaine, you know, they like that better.
Goes in faster.
So it has to do with route of administration, and the poison used, fentanyl, which is an extremely powerful narcotic. I mean, you get sprayed in the face, you go down. Down. And if it's too much, you quit breathing and die. That's exactly what happened in Russia. In the theater, remember, where the Chechen took over the theater? The Russians, they brought in all their SWAT team types, which are probably a lot more aggressive than ours, and they basically just sprayed fentanyl into the theater.
Painkiller.
And it will take you down like this. The terrorists were strapped with bombs. Not a single one saw off a bomb. They went down so fast. One breath, and you're gone. You're unconscious. Fentanyl works that fast. It's 300 times more potent than morphine, and it will take you down. A lot of the people, the patrons that were there at the theater, died because the medics couldn't get in there fast enough to breathe for them. And that's what you do with a narcotic. You breathe for some, the person until it wears off or until you give something to counteract it. A lot of the people died. I forget, 50, 60 of them died. But there were 300 or 400 people in there. So was it worth it? I don't know.
Well, you know, some of the more common ones, like we were talking about, either cocaine, curare, carbon tetrachloride. These are things that would kill in up to a minute. Benzene.
The carbon tetrachloride used to be in carpet cleaning solution.
Oh, it was all over.
And people would go into carpet cleaners would come and they'd come cleaning your house and they'd have all the windows and doors closed because it was raining or cold or whatever outside, and you'd come back 2 hours later and they'd be laying dead in the floor. And their liver would be gone.
And they used to use it for carburetor cleaners and stuff like that in labs. Mercury salts we talked about, hydrogen sulfide. The thing about hydrogen sulfide, it's a gas basically, and it stinks.
Smells like rotten eggs, yeah.
But your nose becomes desensitized to it fairly quickly. So once you've got enough dosage, you can't smell it. And that's when it kills you, because it doesn't take a whole lot.
And the bitter odor of cyanide is genetically determined as to whether you can smell it or not.
That's right.
It's about 50-50. Half the population can, half the population can't.
I can't smell it. I've been in a position where I was actually dragging people out of the room that cyanide had gotten loose in. They were on the floor and I was dragging them out. We all went to the hospital. I had the same amount of cyanide in me that they did. I couldn't smell it.
It's noticeable.
I was standing. I was standing. So.
Were you saying about the top screen?
Yeah.
Does that just monitor a certain reaction within the body so that you know it was something toxic? Or is it set off?
No, the screen is done on stomach contents or blood or urine. And they will take, those are all of them, and they will you put them through really a gas chromatograph mostly, which is a thing that separates out chemicals. And a lot of them can be identified just from that. And there's a couple of other tests that they do.
Yes,
but the point is that what it does is the test in the lab will tell you that an amphetamine's present. So they'll report that back, and then they'll say, do you want to go to the next step? Then the confirmatory test will take the same samples, some of the same stuff, and go into the more sophisticated test and determine what amphetamine is present.
Yeah, but it's not necessarily from the doctor looking at
it. It's not from looking at the individual. In fact, 99% of poisons leave absolutely no clue that they're present.
Right.
None.
Looks like carbon monoxide would, but even that could be confused with other things.
Even that can be confused with other things.
So if you got a toxin back that said that amphetamine is present,
yes.
Do you need to know what it is to be able to treat it, or do you start treating generally?
In the hospital, we treat the effects. If someone's got very high blood pressure and cardiac arrhythmias and rapid heartbeats and all this, we start treating those. And we do have methods of treating those. It helps to know what's causing it, because other things can cause that too.
Right.
And so you start a multi-pronged evaluation of the patient, one of which is a toxicological screen, if you're assuming that some drug's involved. But let's say that they find an amphetamine.
Right.
Well, there's more to it than that. This guy could be having this problem for something totally different. And just because you find an amphetamine doesn't mean it's playing a role. Mm-hmm. So now you need to know what it is and how much. And then you can determine it's not a player in this scenario, it is a contributing factor in this scenario, or it's the cause. A classic example is alcohol. If someone's got a blood alcohol level of 0.3 and they're acting strangely, it's probably not the alcohol that's doing it. But if they got one of 0.14 and they're acting goofy and intoxicated, then it's the alcohol. If they're in a coma, and their blood alcohol level is only like 0.5, you better look for something else. But if it's 0.4, that's the lethal dose. That's the LD50 is 0.4. Then you've got an explanation. So it's the finding of it and the amount of it in that individual under this circumstance.
And also the physical conditions that the person came in, because they might be exhibiting one set of symptoms.
Yes.
You find this in the body, but that wasn't the thing that was causing this thing. But you have to know it was there, because you could screw them up by doing something that would affect that particular compound, too.
What about poisoning someone over a couple of weeks?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Arsenic, the heavy metals, and I don't mean, you know, Nirvana, but
they're
DC,
good,
even though they're pretty good. The heavy metals are the stars of that.
Yeah,
and lead is extremely common, and arsenic is extremely common.
And they also, there's some plants that take quite a while to affect. You could give it to them over a period of time, and it would kill them over, like
trip.
Well, I'd give it to them in a salad. Or
steep it and make a tea out of it.
Yeah.
And then boil it down and concentrate it, and a teaspoon will kill everybody in this room.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to be, you could get creative. Making teas out of it, like I said, boil it down, put the salad, chop it up, and put it in different things. So that basically they won't taste it, unless you give them a teaspoonful. You can even mask that a lot of times. But like I said, joking, put it in a smoothie. Put it in something that's got a flavor, strawberry or something like that.
Bouillabaisse.
Yeah, I mean, anything that's got a flavor to it. Put it on a pizza. I mean, but you can get creative with it, especially with the plants. You can get creative with these things. So that's one of the beauties of these things.
Would that would be traceable.
If you look for it.
If you look for it.
Right, but still take the same question. What would you kill somebody with?
A gun. From a distance. And not tell anybody.
Poison. What poison would you use?
Well, it depends on the circumstances. Yeah.
You have access to the person, you have access to any of these items you talked about today.
Yeah, and again, it still depends on the circumstance. Cyanide still works great.
Yeah, I like the cyanide.
And it's effective. The problem with a lot of poisons is, number one, they don't have timers, and number two, they don't always work.
Mm-hmm.
And murderers like for things to work.
Right.
They don't like to have misfire. Okay, they like for things to work because it usually is a one-shot deal.
So you
if you live with someone or their caregiver or something, you know, like you guys, I mean, she can poison you and you wouldn't know it. But it'll add a little bit of arsenic and a little bit and a little bit and a little bit, and the person gets sick. And the classic example is the husband gets sick, and over three weeks he's developing all these gastrointestinal symptoms, and he's vomiting and he's losing weight. He's having diarrhea, and he's tingling, and and he's got headaches and blurred vision, and he feels terrible, and he goes to the doctor, and the doctor says, I don't know what's going on. We put you in the hospital, and they put him in the hospital, and he's there for 3 or 4 days, and they stick tubes everywhere and do all the stuff, gastroenterologists like to do, and he gets better.
Yep.
And so they send him home, and then he gets sick again. And then he goes there. And pretty soon, the coroner picks him up at home. So what they do is they take his hair.
And
they chop it up into little pieces, and the hair grows about this much. I think it's a centimeter a month. And so they can chop it up and actually test the arsenic levels in those and get a timeline for what it was. And when it goes down, it's the week he was in the hospital. And when it goes back up, it's the week he was home. And so now you say, okay, who has access to his food?
The wife's previous husband also died of arsenic.
Yeah, that's very common, actually. Or disappears in the case of Peterson.
One of the
actually, a risk factor for being murdered is to have the name Peterson.
Well, one of the things you want to look at is that you're talking milligrams usually per kilogram of body weight.
Right.
And the other problem you got is, like Doug said, is the amount of body mass versus the amount you're going to give them, and the type of body mass, fat versus muscle. Because your body operates a little differently depending on your structure, your physical condition. Are you healthy, a strong, healthy person, or are you got medical problems coming out of your tail? So all those things have an effect. Your body's weak. Are you run down? Are you And then, like you said, it's kind of hit and miss because, you know, how much do I give? Well, you can look up in books like ours and find out how much, you know. But even that, you know, if it says like 0.3 milligrams will kill, use a milligram. You know, I mean, because three tenths of a milligram may affect you, kill you, and it may just make me sick. All right? Or may not do a darn thing. Or it may not hurt Doug. So if you give a lot of it, now the problem with giving a lot of it too much is that it's liable to show up someplace. So you've got, now these are the things you've got to weigh. Academic spies and women have liked poisons for eons. I mean, this has been because it's almost civilized. You know, when you stab somebody, it's bloody.
It's not messy.
It's messy. Yeah, they fight back. I mean, you could get hurt.
And you don't have to be there when the person takes it.
Right. So the other method, like shooting someone, you've got to be there. Or you can stand off a little bit. But smuggling, you know, strangling or smothering, you got to be there. You could get hurt. Poisons, it's civilized. I mean,
at Maui Rider Conference many years ago, Dave Barry told this great story. He's a very close friend of Ridley Pearson, and the families they vacationed together a lot. And they were in Sun Valley, and they were in there at a coffee shop one morning, and Dave and Ridley were standing in line waiting to get up to the counter to order their coffee. And he said he noticed Ridley was staring at the person that was grinding a bag of coffee for a customer. You know, they take the beans and grind it, put it in the bag. Dave said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Nothing." He said, "No, you're plotting something. What are you doing?" He said, "Do you know, if you put just a little bit of cyanide on those grinder blades and ground the coffee, the cyanide would only be in the coffee at the bottom of the bag. It may be a month before they get to it." Number one, and number two, most of these things don't really have antidotes. You just treat the problems they cause. Example, heroin overdose. First of all, you breathe for them, because that's what heroin does. It makes you quit breathing and you die from asphyxia. And then you give a drug called Narcan, which reverses like that the result, the effects of narcotics. Now, you may have to get it again in an hour or in another hour or another hour until finally the body destroys the narcotic. But basically what we do in the emergency room is you treat what you can treat and then let nature take care of getting rid of the toxin, because there aren't really true antidotes for most things.
Right. Yeah. And you got to give it to them fast enough.
Yeah. And yeah, think of it first. Yeah.
Is it the milky substance and oleander?
The whole plant. And actually, if you burn it, you inhale the fumes.
Oh,
yeah. So if you're ever going to burn your shrubbery, don't stand downwind from the oleander.
Yeah, and you know how some of the big oleander plants, they have the big stems that are like this, the woody.
Yeah.
Don't burn them as something to cook over.
Right.
Eucalyptus could have a similar effect. You don't want to burn that in your fireplace necessarily.
See, the most dangerous place in the world is the hospital. You don't want people to die there all the time. Sorry, I'm not going to tell you this. Number two, they're set up. They're set up for all kinds of poisons, insulin, potassium, like you talked about. They got IVs. They already got access. You don't have to find an access route. You don't have to have another stick. They already got an IV running. Squirt it in and go mop the floors. I mean, and it happens all the time, and that's why these angels of death that stalk hospitals are almost impossible to find. The way they're always found is when the body count gets high enough, someone gets suspicious, and they start comparing access.
Mm-hmm.
Who was working on these shifts at this time? And it always narrows down to one or two people. And that's how they're caught 9 times out of 10.
Yeah,
or they tell somebody.
It isn't due to the forensics people.
Lean start that?
Yeah, sociopathic person.
You know, they don't all get jobs in
hospital. You'd be surprised. Well, that's pretty much. I mean, it's just like every other profession. I mean, there's killers out there everywhere, and there's sociopathic killers out there everywhere. It's just in the hospital, it's so dramatic that it makes the newspaper. Because you're so vulnerable when you're
in the hospital. They just caused the death.
Yeah. They get a thrill out of that. It gives them a sense of power and fulfillment or whatever.
There's a recent study that was actually done by one of the deans at Cal State LA. I'm sure people who have literally can find it. But there've been some real recent studies out about hospital murders because, well, from Dr. Shipley, probably the biggest mass murder in history that we with contemporary history is an English country doctor.
Yeah.
Shipley.
Maybe killed 200 something people.
Yeah. Oh, and
all by himself.
And there have been some recent studies. So if you look out there, if you Google things like or look through medical literature of it, there's quite a bit that's coming out now about
a very famous one was Janine Jones from not far from where you live in Kerrville, Texas, and she was a nurse who worked for this pediatrician. And the pediatrician was new in town, and suddenly all of her little patients started having problems. They quit breathing. Mm-hmm. And Janine Jones would come in, would do the CPR and breathe for them and, do all the stuff and save their lives. Well, it turned out, to make a long story short, she left there and went down to San Antonio to the pediatric hospital, and lo and behold, same stuff started happening. And she actually injected a patient, which was using succinylcholine, which is a paralytic drug, in a helicopter. On the way from Kerrville to, it's an incredible story. And basically she was doing it because it fed her self-importance. Mm-hmm. If she could make this baby quit breathing and then save the baby's life, she was a hero. So the reasons that people do this stuff are widely varied. Some of them are just serial killers.
Yeah.
Some of just...
You may remember Dr. Carl Capolino.
Oh, yeah.
Injected his wife, Carmella, with succinylcholine,
yes,
in the toes as she slept.
Right.
And
in fact, that was the case where succinylcholine, they got Halpern up in New York to actually devise the test to find succinic acid, which was the breakdown product of succinylcholine. And that was the first time succinylcholine was ever found.
And to add to that story, he was convicted, sentenced to 12 years in prison, which is what you get for killing your wife.
Exactly. But he got in trouble because the other woman told on him.
Yes. But one of the things when you're looking at it,
definitely Bailey's first.
If you can find the poison, that would be one thing. But a lot of times they don't. And a lot of poisons, people are poisoned, and it goes completely undetected. The medical examiners, the coroners don't find it.
We have time for one more question, is that it?
Oh, I was wondering if you could discuss the foxglove and digitalis a little more.
Yeah. Well, digitalis is a glycoside, and that's a class of medications. And what they do primarily is affect the heart. And they make the heart rhythm become very erratic. They promote what we call ventricular arrhythmias, and these are changes in heart rhythm from the lower chambers of the heart, and they're deadly. Ventricular tachycardia, ventricular fibrillation. When you hear someone say they had a cardiac arrest, that's what it was, one of those two, almost invariably. And that's what digitalis does. Now, it can make you nauseated. It can make your vision turn yellow if you take it over a period of time. And we see this in patients. Because it's amazing how many people think that if one's good, two's better. And I always tell people when I started on digitalis, this is not one of those medicines. You take it absolutely. And so we check blood levels periodically. And the therapeutic range is between 1.0 and 2.0. It's very narrow. Above, they start getting toxic effects, and below, they may not get the full therapeutic effect. It's got a very narrow range. Foxglove is where it came from. As we talked about earlier, all of our drugs came from plants, basically. Very few are synthetically produced, and those that are were basically synthetic versions of what was found in plants by Galen and all those people that followed.
Aspirin is a good example.
Aspirin's a perfect example. Quinidine, all of us.
Yeah.
But
one of the things that
that's what glycosides do, and the foxglove is, again, if you make a tea out of it or you chop it up, you can kill it.
Last question.
Okay.
Actually, this isn't a question, but this whole thing has made me reflect on what a beautiful concept Quincy was.
Yeah.
The one mandate for anyone who was going to write for the show was all the clues had to come from the body.
Yeah.
Do you realize that he got badge number 2 of the in Las Vegas, Clark County's coroner's office, the guy that played Quincy, what was it?
Jack Abelard.
He's got badge number 2, the coroner's office, because they like the show.
But I mean, what a great... makes me appreciate what a great concept it was for a series.
Sure.
And Tom didn't even write for that show.
the only one.
You mentioned the drugs that the doctors. One of the things you'll find in a lot of handbooks, chemical handbooks, is what a lot of chemicals taste like. even the arsenic compounds, the cyanide compounds, we know what they taste like. Because the old alchemists and the old chemists back, you know, back in the days of old...
That's how they found stuff.
They tasted everything they made. Sometimes it was the last entry in the notebook.
Diabetes was diagnosed because she tasted the patient's urine in it.
Sure.
It was sweet. I'm glad I came along later.
Thank you, Doug and Dave. Their books are on sale. I'll never eat or breathe or drink.